Hello and welcome to another edition of Happy Monday with me, Martin Beebe, and the enormous microphone. Today I'm joined by Steve Plank. He's a cloud evangelist at Microsoft, and we're going to be talking about apps and data. So Steve, what has the cloud got to do with applications?
Right, well, I think the cloud's especially important to mobile applications because they're the kind of they're the new kid on the block and everybody wants to build one. And as soon as you want to save data somewhere other than on the device, the simplest way to do it is to use the cloud because it's so easy to provision it. You don't really need to take care of it. You don't need to do any service management. And it means that data can then be shared amongst lots of other devices, either ones you own or ones that you want to, owned by people you want to interact with.
Steve, you work on the same team as me, evangelizing kind of cloud computing and Azure, the product. What does Azure really have to offer application developers?
Yeah, so, I mean, if you think about a continuum where there's simple mobile applications at this end and really complicated ones at this end, which are going to have lots of back-end services, maybe a really complicated and high-end game which is doing machine learning, it's collecting data from the device on the play itself, it's doing analysis of all of that data to work out how to improve the game. It's probably got, you know, specialist server roles, maybe two or three servers which are specialized for doing things like communication and doing things like scheduling where things should work. Then that is really the job of a part of the Azure cloud called cloud services. So you can build APIs that the mobile device would connect to and then have this big server infrastructure at the back end that's going to do that. As you move further along the complexity continuum and you get to the really simple end, that's where most apps live. And what you think about what most of those apps want to do, the first thing they want to do is they want to just store some data. If it's a game, they want to store their high score. Maybe they want to store the level they got to so that the guy who's playing the train on his Android phone on the way home on the train, when he gets in through the door, he can pick up his Surface device and carry on where he left off, something like that. Perhaps they want to have push notifications, so it'd be easy to inform people that are using the application about things that have happened. Perhaps that they'd want to do, maybe you'd want to have your cloud service, your cloud backend to do some kind of scheduled job every so often and inform people about what's going on. And then, of course, one of the other things is you probably want to know who these people are so you can identify each one of them and give them the services they need. So integration into the common identity providers like, you know, using your Twitter account to log into your application or using Facebook or Google or Microsoft or even, actually, since last week, logging into corporate active directories, which are used by big enterprises to manage their whole user base.
So you talked there a little bit about an application developer moving from, say, an Android device over to a Surface or a Windows device. And I guess they might have iPads and they might have iOS devices. I guess if you're going to build a mobile service, it's going to have to work across all kinds of platforms. How does Azure kind of fare when it comes to working cross-platform?
If you think about that simple end of the spectrum there, the idea of that is that you build your cloud service, you build your mobile service. It's very simple to do. You go click, 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 type in a few things, hit OK, and about less than 30 seconds later, the mobile service that you need is created. You then have a piece of client software, like a proxy, that gets loaded into each of the types of clients that you're going to use. So you might have one for an Android device, one for a Windows phone, one for a Windows 8 application, one for iOS, one for a Xamarin application, one for a PhoneGap application, one for HTML and JavaScript. And they all talk, or they all give you some objects and some methods that you can use to call. And what comes out of the bottom of that proxy is a bunch of REST calls, you know, create, read, update, delete type operations, where the payload is in a JSON package. And the mobile service then just rips that apart, takes the JSON package out for you, and says, what do you want to do with this? You can put it into a database. You could put it into table storage. You could put it into a NoSQL database. You can make the decision once you've got that data at the cloud end, what you want to do with that data or whether you want to return it to the user themselves. But the point is that you make the cloud, the mobile service, one mobile service, but it can handle every individual type of client, whether that's, you know, an Android device or an iOS device or a PhoneGap or Xamarin or Windows Phone, Windows 8, and HTML JavaScript.
So when we look at your continuum of complexity, the Azure offering is the simple Azure offering is called Azure Mobile Services. Is that right?
Azure Mobile Services.
Let's say I'm building a game and I've got some high scores. How do I go and put that into the cloud?
Okay, so in the case of mobile services, you'll create a table object, and then you just have some methods on that, like adding items, removing items, updating items, deleting items. So it's really quite simple. You know, you've got this mobile services client piece of software. It's a binary piece of software that gets loaded down into the device itself, and then that gives you a bunch of classes. You can instantiate those classes, and then you can call the methods on them to update or read from or delete data in the database that you've created.
It seems quite an important thing to note that you're not setting up tables and columns in your database when you sort of create it. What you're doing is you're creating these objects, which then you're passing over to Azure Mobile Services as like JSON objects. And then it's looking at those objects and kind of inferring what the database should look like. So is that right?
Yeah, so by default, to make this really simple, by default, the way it works is, if you create something that requires an extra column in the data in the database, then the mobile service will say, "Oh, we haven't got a place to put this data. We better create a new column." It'll create the column and populate it with your data. Now, that's something that you might want to turn off by the time you get into a true, you know, fully blown production system, because you could imagine somebody who knows that this happens. Well, what they might do is start writing their own code and calling your mobile service and just putting lots of extra data on, and you could find the width of your database increasing because of all the extra columns that are there. So by default, we make it really easy for you to do this kind of thing. But by the time you get into a large, deployed, fully active, probably commercially successful application, you want to start to protect that sort of thing. And so the ability is also there to protect that as well.
So you have your object and you send it over to the cloud. What happens?
Okay, so let's just imagine we've done something like adding an item. So we've got an object, we've got a method, we're adding an item, and we specify the data that we're going to add. What happens is that data then goes down through the mobile services client and comes out into a REST call. Let's just say that's going to be a insert operation with a JSON package with the data in it. That travels across the wire, hits the mobile service, hits the REST interface. The mobile service then picks that up, and it offers you the opportunity to say, for the insert, the read, the update, and the delete operations, would you like to do something with this data that we've just pulled out of that JSON package? Would you like to get hold of that data and do something before we put it into the database? So one of the things that we do there's a piece of lab work that you can do just to get familiar with this, is we look at the length of the string and we say, you know, is that greater than 10 characters? And if it's greater than 10 characters, then we'll raise an exception and we'll send the exception back to the client, and they'll say, oh, you can't put any more than 10 characters here. So that might be the sort of thing that we might want to do. In the early days of mobile services, we would do things like maybe add some extra data at this stage, which would be the date and time of the update that was going to happen into the database. We automatically do that now, but these are simple examples of the sort of thing that you might want to do. So you can intercept what is happening with your data from the moment it hits the REST service and in between when it hits that REST service and when it gets to the database.
So to clarify, what language am I writing this in?
So today, you can either do that in JavaScript, it's a Node.js engine, or C#. It's up to you.
Ah, so C# is new, because when I looked at this before, it was just JavaScript and Node.
Yeah, so we introduced, probably a few months ago now, we introduced an idea that you could use Web API, and you could effectively configure Web API to give you those REST interfaces to do that job for you. So that naturally then would say, use Visual Studio and C# to create that code.
So when these objects hit the cloud services RESTful endpoints and they get added to the database, can I access that database?
Okay, so if you use just the vanilla services which are available, then it will end up in the database, which is part of the mobile service when you create it. So when you go through the wizard and you create a mobile service, it says, what do you want your mobile service to be called? mobileservices.net, something like that. And then it says, do you want to use an existing SQL database that you already have in the cloud? This is a Microsoft SQL or a Windows Azure SQL DB database. It's a database service that the cloud offers. Or do you want to create a brand new one? So you have your mobile service and you have your database, and the two things are tied together. Now, if you write your code in Web API in C#, and you create a Visual Studio project and you upload that project to your mobile service, You can then actually do anything that you want with that data. You could write to another database. You could write it into storage. You could even do something like create a MongoDB and read and write from that if you wanted to. So the simple option is that you just use that database which is already provided and you just intercept those simple operations, or you write the whole thing in Visual Studio and then you start to expand that and make it into a bit more of a complicated beast. But for the simple end, you don't really need to do that. It's only as you start to move up the complexity scale up towards really complex applications that you need to consider doing that kind of thing.
So when people start building an application, they've got no idea generally how successful that's going to be. How do they know how it's going to scale? How does it scale? And also, what's the cost implications of this scalability?
Well, let's just go through the process. First thing to do is to sign up to a free Windows Azure trial subscription. And you can do that at aka.ms/azure_trial. Next, once you've got your free subscription, then create the mobile service. And you can create up to 10 mobile services with your free subscription, and they'll be free forever. So, even though your free subscription lasts for 30 days, that's for all the other services that you might use in Windows Azure. Websites, Windows Azure websites, and Windows Azure mobile services, you can have 10 of those each for free forever. Now, there's a few limitations on those. So, for example, of all the mobile services that you've got, in order to have them for free, completely free, then you can't take out of the data center any more than 165 megabytes per day. So you can put as much data as you want into this mobile service, but as soon as you start pulling data out of it, onto the internet, out to all the different apps that you've got running, clients that are running, then it's 165 megs per day. You can have up to 500,000 API calls per day, and you can support up to 500 unique devices per day. So all of that is free. So, if you're doing more than that, you've got an app which is probably bordering on becoming successful. And then you can start paying for the service. And you start paying in groups of 1.5 million API calls per day. We call that a unit. And that is, I think it's £16. So it's something like £16. Might be £16.99. I'm not absolutely sure. But around the £16, £17 mark. And so let's imagine that your application is so popular that you're doing more than 1.5 million. Let's just say you're doing 3 million. Well, then you need two units. You need one unit that's capable of scaling for that, and you need another unit. So that's going to cost you twice as much, because you pay per unit, and per unit is able to do 1.5 million API calls. Then you get up to where you've got, I can't remember what it is, maybe sort of 10 of those, and you can then switch over to doing 15 million API calls in one go. Now, to support 15 million API calls costs £127 per month. But you're really into quite a successful application at that stage. And then you can scale up in chunks of 15 million API calls per day. So, the whole point of this is that you can start off testing something out up to 500,000 API calls per day and 500 individual clients for nothing. And then if that works, then you'll only be paying £16 per month to scale up to the next level, and then only £32 per month, and so on, until you start to get into the really big numbers. And by then, you've got a really big, successful service.
So in its most simplest form, Azure Mobile Services stores some data, these data objects. It's like an abstraction over a database, really. I do know there's a few other features like, user credentials and notifications. Can you explain a bit of those? Maybe start with user credentials and user management.
So you might, for example, want to store each individual user's high score and be able to get them to retrieve their own high score. Well, that means you need to know who they are. And so what mobile services does is it integrates with all the common identity providers. So you can use the OAuth protocol, Open Authorization Protocol, and what that does is again, it uses JSON. It packages what are called claims, information about a user, typically some kind of an identifier, into a token, which is just a JSON package. So let's just say that you were going to use a mobile service that was going to use Twitter as a logon. And the ones that are supported are Twitter, Facebook, Microsoft, Google, and a corporate Active Directory if you were writing an enterprise application. So let's imagine you're going to use Twitter. What will happen is you'll fire your application up and you're going to call a login method. that is going to cause a sort of a switchover to Twitter, which is going to render a sign-in page, and that some HTML will be rendered inside your window, inside your mobile application. And you'll see there, say, username and password, and it will say, application, you know, ABC is asking for your permission to log in to use the application. Do you agree to this? So if you type your username and password in, your Twitter ID and your password, and you click OK, then it checks that that's a genuine password, and it will then create a JSON package with details about you in it. And it will only contain just a horrible, you know, long identifier string. That will then get returned to the mobile client, and then you'll be able to sort of say, in the user object, which is in part of the request, you get in any request, you get the item, which is the data, you get the user, and you get the request. So the user, that you could identify who this user was. And so one of the things you might want to do is you might want to say, you know, put an update into the database where you take the user.userID and write that into the database so that when you do a query to retrieve that data, you say only where user.userID equals whatever the user ID is. So you can separate the data out. So what happens is, you know, you fire your mobile application up, it goes to Twitter, Twitter prompts you for a username and a password, you type that in, it produces an OAuth token in a JSON package, returns that to the client then passes that on to the mobile service itself, the mobile service can extract that data, and it will give you that user object, and you can user.userID, and you can find out the identity of the user inside that package.
And notifications, how does that work?
Yeah, so notifications, what we do with mobile services is we sort of we leverage the existing notification services that are out there. So if it's an iOS application, then you know it's got a really nice infrastructure already built in to use Apple push notification services. So what we do is we have a mobile service which talks to Apple push notification services, and that's what does the actual push itself. The mobile service is just basically the supplier of the data of what you want to push. So we do that for Apple push notification services, Google Cloud Messaging, which is obviously very popular among the Android community, Windows Notification Services, that's popular amongst Windows Store apps and Windows Phone applications, and a new type, or not a new type, but a type of notification service which is designed rather than just sending one or two messages to one or two individuals. Maybe if you want to broadcast a message to many millions of individuals, then Notification Hubs is a way of doing that, and that's tested up to, I believe it's tested up to 250 million, a message going out to 250 million users in one shot.
So you're talking about lots of different units. When the client is talking to the Azure Mobile Service, is it just talking to one single service and then there's load balancing going on?
Yeah, that's right. So when the user comes in to the data center, they hit a load balancer, and the load balancer load balances those requests across all the different units. So we don't, you know, we call them units because we don't identify, is a unit an individual server? Is it a collection of servers? Is it a big server? Is it a small server? We don't really identify that. What we do is we say a unit is capable of handling 15 million API calls per day. And, you know, over a period of time, sometimes it might be lots of small servers, sometimes it might be one big server. You don't really know what it is. But you do know when you have lots of units, you have lots of scalability, and we scale out really rather than up. So we don't really sort of add memory and CPUs to an individual unit. We just create more and more units to scale the whole thing out. And it can be done on the fly as well. So you could sort of say, I'd like a few more units now, and you click a button and give you some extra units. But you can also say, I'd like to scale based on CPU utilization. Actually, I might have that wrong. I'm getting a little bit mixed up between websites and mobile services. But I think it's CPU utilization and the number of items in the queue. So you could say, you know, I never want to scale beyond, let's just say, 5 units, because that's going to cost me too much. So I'll hold my cost by never scaling more than 5. When I get to whatever the threshold is, that will be a trigger for me to scale up to add one more unit. And if I hit that threshold in that unit, then I scale up again, and so on until I hit 5. And then maybe when the utilization goes down to, let's just say, 60%, then I scale back, and I go down to 60% and I scale back again. So I can scale up and back automatically based on how busy the service is. And that's a really good way of saving money, because it means you don't have lots of units sat there doing nothing most of the time. The only time the units are provisioned is when the service is busy, probably during busy times for the application. And on all of the times, the thing just gradually scales itself back again.
You have all of these units, all these servers. Who's patching and updating all of those?
Yeah, so this is kind of like the most important thing about a mobile service is that, as I said at the beginning, the mobile developer is interested in the device, and they're typically not interested in all the stuff that happens at the back end. So if you think about a traditional service where, you know, if you're going to build a back end, you'd probably get some hosting provider to give you a server, and you'd install an operating system, and then you'd install the patches onto it, and then you'd install in frameworks like, you know, whether you're going to use Java or .NET, and then they've got their own sets of patches. And then platforms like, you know, Apache or IIS, and they've got their own sets of patches. And then you put your application on it, and that's got its own set of patches, because you'll find bugs with that as well. And you're into a whole world now of actually managing a service. And you've got to do really simple things like, you know, make sure that the operating system disk doesn't get to around about 95% full, and operating systems really start to slow down at that stage. So you come from, you're interested in developing for this device, and suddenly you're doing stuff like monitoring the disk space on a server in a data center that is run somewhere else, probably hundreds of miles away. So that's not the sort of thing that the developer is really interested in. So Microsoft has an automated system which takes care of all of that kind of service management, patching, daily management tasks, all of that kind of stuff is done by somebody else, and it's automatically done. And even does failure management. So if one of your units fails, then Microsoft software will automatically bring in a new server, and it will do it in a coordinated way so you don't lose requests, for example. And all of that will happen for you so that you don't have to worry about it.
I just want to thank Steve for taking the time out to speak to us today. So we're going to break there, and we're going to go and have a look at a video Mike Tolte put together where he's going to see which is faster, setting up an Azure mobile service or boiling an egg. Check it out.
While undertaking my daily activity of cataloguing pretty much everything that's on the internet, I came across this video that Michael had made on YouTube of how to boil an egg in real time, a soft-boiled egg. It seemed like a fascinating video, so I started watching it. And it made me wonder which would be quicker. Would Michael be able to boil this egg, soft-boiled, quicker than I could create a cloud service in Windows Azure? I thought I'd try it out. So, I ran up a web browser, navigated over to Windows Azure, logged in, which is something that Windows just does for me on a site like this, and then went across to these mobile services over here. Mobile services is a way in which you can create a cloud backend for a mobile app running on iOS, Android, Windows, Windows Phone, PhoneGap, Xamarin, anything that can invoke RESTful APIs, including a web page. So I can use this whizzy little dialog down the bottom of the screen to create a new service. I could call this the egg service. I might like a free 20 megabyte database to hold my data. I might want to put this in Northern Europe. I might want to say OK. I might want to put this on a new database server with a login and a password. Oops, you nearly saw my secure password. I can tick the little box and let that start creating. Meanwhile, let's just see how Michael's going. Still 4 minutes over here to get the egg. That seems like a long time for a soft-boiled egg, but he has got four, I think, in the pan there, so, and he's just wiggled it around a little bit. So maybe that's why it's going to take a little bit longer than you might otherwise expect. Meanwhile, my cloud service is still being created, so there's still a little bit of tension here as to whether Michael's going to finish first or whether I'm going to finish first. But I'm confident. I think this is going to win out. Let's see how Michael's getting on. Egg's still there on the pan. Yeah, I don't think those are done just yet. Meanwhile, Windows Azure is still creating me a SQL server, a web server to run some web services hosted in Node.js with custom logic written in JavaScript, and setting up the security on that thing. Eggs. Egg service. Ooh, the egg service is ready. Let's just check on the eggs. Yeah, they're still going. Okay, let's pop into the egg service, and maybe I want some data here. Now, I might want to download an app for Windows, iOS, Android, JavaScript, Xamarin, or PhoneGap that knows how to code against this service, but maybe I'll just create a data table. Let's call this the egg table. And let's set some permissions on this while the egg's still in progress. Let's say that everyone can do whatever they want with my particular table here. And let's save that. And so now we've got a table. And so what might be nice, I suppose, would be to see if we can get some data into that table. So how's the egg going over there? No, the egg's not really... I'm not even sure that pan's boiling. Anyway, let's carry on. We've got our egg table up there, so maybe what we could do is run some kind of environment. Let's run a scripting environment. Let's see if we can see anything in that egg table. So let's use Windows PowerShell in this case, but we could use anything we want to invoke a REST method. URI is going to be HTTPS, maybe. I think we call it the egg service. And there'll be a table up there called egg table. The egg's halfway done, by the way, over there. And well done for your perseverance. But I think we're going to beat Michael and his egg service. It looks like I'm already going to be able to invoke that REST method. Now, no data comes back from that table, but my service is live on the internet. Let's see if I can put some kind of data into that table. Let's say, let's have a little record of data here. Let's say a record is some kind of tuple where we'll say name equals Mike. Let's say status equals winner. Let's say something like... time equals 4 minutes, something like that. Let's create that record. Let's convert that to JSON. So let's say, hey, get some JSON, which we could just say, take that record and convert it to, not CSV, but JSON. Now we've got some JSON data. Let's go and invoke a REST method again up at that URI. How's the egg doing? The egg's steaming over there. We need to get on with this. Let's say that the method we want over here is going to be a post. Let's say that the body over here is going to be that JSON data. And let's say that the content type is going to be application. JSON. My data's in the table. Let's pop back over to the cloud. Let's have a look at that data in the table. And, you know, just while the egg's steaming away over there, it's safe to say that having data like this just publicly accessible on the internet probably isn't a great idea. So let's just change those permissions back. Let's say, no, sorry, you need to be an authenticated user. And let's just save that. And let's pop back to our command prompt to just make sure that if we try and get data from that table, we should now be unauthorized. Because what we just did was switched on OAuth authentication for that table, and we have easy support for doing that with Facebook, for doing it with Google, for doing it with Microsoft, for doing it with Twitter, or even doing it with Azure Active Directory. But that would be another story. Let's just see how the egg's going on. It looks like there might be a few more minutes to run, so I'm going to let you watch that in your own time. I think conclusively we have proved that we can do this faster than boiling an egg, even live on the internet.
I love that. Anyway, that's it for this week's Appy Monday. I hope you've enjoyed the show. Come back next week, same time, same place, for another edition of Appy Mondays. Thank you very much.